Welcome to the Unbound Healing Podcast. I'm Anne-Marie Garland, nutritional therapist and health coach at Grassfed Salsa, and with me is my co-host Michelle Hoover, certified nutritional therapy practitioner and writer of everything you'll find at Unbound Wellness. Here we share everything about overcoming health challenges from autoimmunity to hormone imbalance and more, with holistic living, mindset shifts, practical tips, and a real food paleo approach. Remember our disclaimer, the content within this podcast is intended to provide general information and is not to be substituted for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Now let's get on with the show.
What is up, fellow crunchy friends? This week, Anne and I have an amazing, amazing guest for you guys. You all already know her, Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of thepaleomom.com. Dr. Sarah Ballantyne is a medical biophysicist, and her work is incredibly impactful in the autoimmune health space. She authored the book, The Paleo Approach, and is coming out with another book, The Paleo Principles, and we are just honored and excited to be able to have her here on this podcast. So let's go talk to her.
All right. Welcome, Sarah. We are just Yeah, of course. We're just going to jump right in. We've already introduced you to our audience. So why don't you tell us what you are loving right now? We like to do this as kind of an icebreaker, and it can be health related or not, just anything that you are just kind of making your life better right now.
So you know what's really making my life better right now is the Outlander series on Stars. Is really, really, really making my life better. It's just, this was my favorite book series, and now it's my favorite television series, and it has nothing to do with health and wellness whatsoever.
No, I love
it's
that.
It's just, as Diana Gabaldon fans, if there are any other listeners who are Diana Gabaldon fans, we all get really, like, we get really upset when we find her books in the romance section of a bookstore because they're not romance novels, they're historical fiction. but there's a pretty heavy romance thread through the stories. So that is my what is that? My junk time.
That's what it is.
But it's junk time that just it really does. I look forward to Sunday every week because of that.
I think it's so important to have non-health things that you can also find joy from. I think in this space, we can get so obsessed with the food and all of the different things that come into it. But I always like sharing non-health things as well, because it's important.
Well, and I'm not, you know, I dedicate so much time in my life to things that are tied to my health. So I dedicate time to mindfulness practice and to exercise and activity and to sleep and to bonding with my family and food, shopping, preparation, cooking, to all of the resources that I'm working on creating for other people. And I don't really do very much like consumption of media time. Like I don't spend very much time on social media other than connecting with readers. And I don't watch very much television. So I think in part because those things can be such time sinks for people that it ends up detracting from health promoting behaviors. For me, it's such a like carefully measured out time commitment because my focus is the time commitment to health promoting behaviors that it becomes something that's much more cherished compared to, like I don't watch television to veg out, right? Like, I don't watch a ton of, ton of different things. And so, so for me, I think it hits a more, it just becomes a little bit more precious time, right? It's a little bit more, it's more focused, it's more engaged. And it's adding to my life rather than, sucking away time, which I think is one of the challenges that a lot of us face is that these things that were originally designed to enrich our lives end up becoming commitments right? We're committed to posting on Facebook and mm-hmm. letting our, you know, family know, you know, what our kids wore to school that day. And I think we get really wrapped up in these things. They become not just what they're supposed to be, which is, you know, some ways to enrich our lives, but they become commitments and time sinks and sources of stress and sources of sort of competition and envy, right? There's all this research to show that a lot of people, it actually hurts their mental health to spend time on social media. So I try instead to take a step back, and then my time that is spent doing those things becomes very engaged, mm-hmm. and it's purely life enrichment rather than a commitment or some kind of detractor from life.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that wisdom. We're already off to an amazing start. Wow. That was like the fluffiest question, and it was already just like the best answer.
So time to retire that question. Yeah.
So before we started diving a little bit deeper into more of the nitty gritty about AIP, mm-hmm. I would be remiss to not ask you about your own personal health and healing story, because that's one of the things that makes you such an amazing person in this industry and in this world, that, you know, you not only do you have the expertise, but you have the personal experience and the passion and the story. So could you share, if listeners aren't aware already, just a little bit about your own story?
Yeah. So, you know, it is my own struggles with health throughout my life that is the driving force behind everything that I do. It just so happens that I also have this, you know, technical medical research background that I can apply to creating resources. But the thing that motivates me really is creating resources to help help people not have to hit the lows that I had to hit before I was able to find solutions. So my symptoms started with puberty. I started gaining weight in a way that just didn't make sense for how my family ate or how active I was as a kid. I was tired all the time. I would sleep on the school bus to and from school. If we drove, you know, more than a mile down the road, I'd fall asleep in the car. I had gastrointestinal symptoms. I started getting migraines in my teens. I had a host of skin problems, you know, had eczema and really bad acne and very dry skin, scalp psoriasis. And I grew up in a family that normalized a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in hindsight, I think that autoimmune disease runs pretty rampant through my family. But the net effect was, oh yeah, everybody in our family gets super constipated when we travel. Oh yeah, you're a sleeper like your uncle. You know, oh yeah, you know, everyone, like everyone had such dry skin in our family that we would just have all of these, like, here's this home remedy, or here's this, you know, new moisturizer that I really like. Like, it just became a conversation point of here's my solution. And everything was about normalizing symptoms that were not normal, and just attributing it to the, you know, the gene pool, right? It runs in the family, and I'm sure it does, but what it amounted to was eventually 4 autoimmune disease diagnoses. So probably those early symptoms were attributable to Hashimoto's thyroiditis, although I was not diagnosed for 30 years. Scalp psoriasis, another autoimmune skin condition called lichen planus, I was diagnosed with in my early 20s. Gastroesophageal reflux disease, severe asthma, allergies, irritable bowel syndrome. I would get repetitive strain injuries really easily, carpal tunnel syndrome. I started having anxiety attacks in my early 20s, debilitating migraines. And then I was morbidly obese by my late teens. I was close to 300 pounds at my heaviest in my mid 20s. And everything was, everything was blamed on me. So as I was growing up, well, you're overweight, so you must be sneaking food. You must be eating something you're not supposed to. So it was always, everything was really tied to my weight. Like, that was my dominant problem. And I really felt very simplistically in my teens and 20s that being overweight was my problem, and that if I could just lose the weight, clearly my life would be magically wonderful. And so it didn't happen. I mean, I lost the weight in a very unhealthy way. I drove myself into a major flare, at which time I was apartment bound, I had severe adult onset asthma, was actually coughing up blood. My lungs were so inflamed, and was put on extremely high doses of steroids for months, gained all the weight back. And I just became defeated. I started suffering depression. I felt like if nothing I do makes a difference, then what does it matter what I do? So then I developed binge eating disorder. And I guess in the grand scheme of self-medicating coping strategies, that's probably not the worst, but it definitely didn't help. So then I developed metabolic syndrome, so high blood pressure. I was borderline type 2 diabetic. And I, you know, all the time, right, going through grad school and my first postdoc was at a really high profile institution that was very, very competitive. I was working 80-hour weeks routinely. And, you know, studying things like inflammation, systemic inflammatory response syndrome, sort of things that go wrong in critical care wards where your immune system breaks down and attacks your own body. So it's a very acute dysfunction of the immune system compared to the more chronic dysfunction of the immune system that happens in autoimmune disease. But, you know, all of the same mechanisms at play. I ended up doing epithelial cell biology and doing some cancer biology, but studying tight junction formation, right, which is something that's so profoundly relevant to gut health. And all the time, my science career was completely separate. My science background was completely separate from this problem of my health. So when my first daughter was born, I had the foresight to realize I was not healthy enough to do both of these really hard things. If she was colicky, she didn't sleep. And I, you know, I had all of these like dreams of motherhood that involved, you know, being a really engaged, energetic mother. So I decided to take time off my research career at that point. And that was probably one of the best decisions I've ever made. Even though I, you know, as a very young researcher, I was an award-winning researcher. I had my own grants as a postdoc, which is extremely unusual. So I was on track for a really high-profile academic career. And I just went, I need to take a break, and I need to focus on this baby. And what it actually ended up allowing me to do was focus on myself. Mm-hmm. And so my first foray into actually really getting control of my health was losing 100 pounds. And then I got pregnant again with my second daughter and did have a much healthier pregnancy. At that point, I had reversed the metabolic syndrome. So my blood pressure was normal. My blood sugar regulation was normal. I was a little bit overweight, but much closer to a healthy weight, and was able to, you know, avoid things like gestational diabetes and preeclampsia with the second pregnancy, which were great things. But my depression, anxiety, my skin conditions, irritable bowel syndrome, all of these things were still really present in my life and very invasive. So they were really destroying my quality of life. And I had this moment when I was watching my, you know, toddler second daughter playing in her room. And it was summer. At this point, we were living in Atlanta. So they call it Hotlanta for a reason. So summer in Atlanta, and I'm wearing pants and long sleeves because my skin is so covered in eczema and lichen planus lesions and psoriasis patches that I don't want people to see my skin. And I'm hot and miserable and I have a headache and my joints hurt. And I'm looking at my daughter playing and I just have this, I'd lost weight. Why wasn't I still healthy? And I had this moment where I went, oh, health is more complicated than the weight that you are. And I started researching at that point. I was looking at food sensitivities and their links to eczema, right? That was where I started because that's one of those little tidbits that I think is a little bit easier to hear. Eczema is related to, you know, egg allergies and maybe gluten. And I started researching there, and that was when I had heard about the paleo diet before and thought it sounded crazy. But I landed on it again, and I landed on some more detailed articles that really referenced a lot of science on Lauren Cardain's, the old version of his website. And that got me engaged, and it got me thinking about food as a source of nutrition rather than a source of energy. Because as somebody who had battled weight, you know, you just really think of, if I eat too much, I'm going to gain more weight. And if I eat little enough, then I'll lose some weight. And I had dabbled with low carb, and I had dabbled with calorie counting, and all these bad diets, and with varying success. So to think of food as being a source of nutrients, that my body needs nutrients, that was a really radical change in perspective for me. To think of getting healthy to lose weight instead of losing weight to get healthy was a really radical change in perspective. And so what I ended up doing was really digging into a lot of the science behind the tenets of paleo in order to talk myself into doing it. Because at the time, paleo was always described as, here's all the foods you don't eat. And it, you know, it's very negative. It's a way of introducing a dietary template to people that just says, hey, and you'll be deprived. And that was, you know, that was my initial trepidation. But then when I went paleo, I was able to go off 6 prescription medications that I was taking at the time in 2 weeks. I finally got into a healthy weight range. My irritable bowel syndrome disappeared. Acid reflux disappeared. My migraines disappeared. I have not had a migraine except for one time when I accidentally got exposed to dairy in 6 years. And from the day that I started paleo, and they were a weekly occurrence for 15 years or 17 years before that. And so I became, at that point, I had this experience of proof of the power of diet. And then I became not just really excited about learning more, but also really excited about refining more. So at the time, the autoimmune protocol was, and by the way, if you have autoimmune disease, here's some extra foods to not eat. Terry Walls, TEDx Iowa City talk that went viral on YouTube was brand new. And so I started really applying my scientific background at this point to the problem of my health, but also at the same time trying to understand what was specific to me and what was generally applicable. And then I was inspired to start sharing what I was learning. So that was when I started my website. Very soon, I think I had been blogging for 10 months when I got offered my first book deal. And it really became then not just a continuing to refine my own implementation to be able to really continue to improve my own health with the challenges that I have, but then also, you know, how can I take this science background that I didn't realize at the time, but it's actually like the perfect science background, to be able to dig into all of the research that's relevant and really understand it and pull it together in a meaningful way. How can I take that background? How can I take my personal experience and this, longstanding passion for scientific literacy, but now how I'm applying that to public health? How can I take all of this and create resources so that other people can discover these amazing, powerful solutions without having to be sick for 25 years beforehand? So when I look back at my life and I think it's sort of a useless exercise to go back and say, if I could change something, certainly my life would be very different if I had learned about these things beforehand. Maybe 20 years earlier would have been great. But at the same time, you know, growing up in pain with very little energy, for me, that adversity actually drove me to work harder, to excel further. And so I think that in many ways, that experience of 25 years of being sick is what continues to fuel what I'm doing now. And it continues to be the underlying motivation, because nobody needs to go through that. I mean, it's eating this way really isn't hard, especially when you think about the amazing diversity of health promoting foods that we do get to eat, as opposed to just telling people all the things they're going to miss. And when you wrap in lifestyle, when you wrap in, you know, things like activity and sleep and stress management and connection, work-life balance, those things are all inputs to our health. And it's not hard to enjoy all of the wonderful things that our modern society can offer us while keeping those sort of health-promoting behaviors as top priorities. And it just takes education, right? Most of the world out there doesn't actually know how important it is to eat foods that have nutrients, right? That is not information that is communicated effectively right now. So I've taken it on as my mission to take my personal experience and my education and create these educational resources for people so that, you know, if people can find their solutions earlier and not have to struggle with their health the way I did.
Yeah, that's kind of Michelle and I's mission for this podcast as well, is just to make the whole idea of living with chronic illness and autoimmunity not so overwhelming and daunting and such a dark topic like so many of the forums out there show it as, but just showing it like this doesn't have to be a depressing diet or a difficult diet. It can be something that you can really enjoy and can be a sustainable for the long run.
Absolutely.
So, you mentioned your first book deal and then AIP. So let's get into the specifics of AIP. This actually, like yeah. Michelle and I talk a lot about AIP, but we haven't really given any type of summary of it. So if you could do that and also explain like why this works for people suffering from autoimmune diseases, that would be great.
So the heart of the autoimmune protocol is regulating the immune system and regulating other systems that feed into the immune system. So for example, hormone systems, gut health, right? These are things that are really, really strong influencers of how the immune system is working. So to take a step even a little bit farther back, the autoimmune disease, there's something like 140 different autoimmune diseases. What separates one disease from another is which tissue the immune system is attacking, but they all have this common causal mechanism behind them. So they're all caused by the immune system losing the ability to differentiate a tissue in our body from a foreign invader, a virus or a bacteria, and attacking something in our bodies with the same, you know, fervor that we would attack a parasite or a virus. And what happens is, as damage to that tissue or that organ builds up, that's when we start to get symptoms of the disease, and that's when an autoimmune disease is actually diagnosed. So what is a requirement then is this, like, forgetting that the immune, you know, forgetting that something in our body is actually supposed to be there, but then also this signal to attack. So the immune system in autoimmune disease is not regulating itself very well. It's not turning itself off. So then the idea is to look at what does the immune system need to function? What does it need to be able to regulate itself? So what are the signals to the immune system that are keeping it revved up and aren't giving the immune system the opportunity to regulate and to shut down? So normally if you got a cold virus, your immune system would rev up, you'd fight the virus, and then your immune system would say, hey, look, we defeated this virus, we're good now. It would shut itself, you know, back down to like sentry mode. In autoimmune disease, it never shuts itself back down. So we take a really, really detailed look at what compounds are in foods that may promote that inflammation, that might drive the immune system to go overactive. What nutrients does the immune system need to function effectively and to be able to regulate itself? There's a lot of nutrients that are really specific to the regulatory aspects of the immune system. And then where do lifestyle inputs also impact the system? And then you can kind of take that step out. So we know that gut health is really important to diverse colony of bacteria in our gut. It's really important for immune function. So where does food and lifestyle impact gut health, thereby helping the immune system regulate itself? And same with mental health, right? Neurotransmitter health, and the same with endocrine health or hormone health. So when we take this really detailed look at food, we end up creating a really simple metric for food. So does this food provide valuable nutrients that my immune system needs, that my endocrine system needs, that will feed a healthy digestive tract, a healthy gut microbial community? So what is in this food that is good? What is in this food that my body needs? And then what is in this food that might undermine my health in some way? So what inflammatory compounds are in this food? What compounds in this food that might preferentially feed undesirable types of bacteria in my gut? What compounds are in this food that might negatively impact gut barrier function? So we call this sort of colloquially leaky gut, but the more microscopic version of this is gut barrier function or intestinal permeability. There are compounds in foods that directly impact how the gut barrier functions in a negative way. What compounds in this food might negatively impact my hormone systems or negatively impact my adrenal axis, right? So what is in these foods that might harm me or undermine my health in some way? And then we basically balance things out. I mean, this is what even just the paleo diet is I want to eat a food that has lots of, you know, health promoting nutrients in it and not very much health undermining compounds in it. And I'm going to avoid foods that are on the other side of the pendulum and foods that don't have a lot of nutritive value, but have a lot of compounds in them that might be, you know, inflammatory or undermine my health in another way. And then with autoimmune disease, because a certain part of our risk factor is genetic, about one third of our risk for autoimmune disease is genetic, we look at this genetic factor as really increasing the likelihood of a health undermining compound having a bigger effect, or being deficient in a valuable nutrient having a bigger effect. So we basically say, look, I have a genetic makeup that makes me more sensitive to the impact that diet and lifestyle have on my health. Therefore, I have to do things a little bit better. So I'm going to be stricter about these foods in the middle that have some valuable nutrition, but maybe some inflammatory compounds, and I'm going to take those out of my diet. So from that respect, the autoimmune protocol really takes out some foods that are generally included in the paleo diet that have more of a capacity to cause inflammation or negatively impact gut health, while incorporating an even greater focus on nutrient density. So incorporating this focus on eating foods that really do provide the most nutrients per calorie or per bite of that food. And then we take a step backwards and we go, well, food's only one input to health. You know, how well and how much we sleep is really, really critical to immune function. How well we manage chronic stress is really, really critical to immune function. How active we are and versus how sedentary we are is very, very important for immune function. And there's these other aspects like connection, nature time. These things are also feed into hormone systems that help regulate the immune system. So we incorporate all of these different inputs to health with really, I think, equal focus. So I think there's really equal focus on the dietary aspects versus the lifestyle aspects in order to create the opportunity for our immune systems to regulate themselves and the nutritional resources for our immune systems to regulate themselves. So that's sort of the big picture view. What that translates to in terms of diet is a diet that's predominantly, you know, all kinds of seafood, fish, shellfish, sea vegetables, high quality meats, eating snout to tail, so incorporating organ meat into our diet, tons of vegetables. I recommend a minimum of 8 servings a day, some fruit, and healthy fats, so things like coconut oil or lard from pasture-raised pigs, or tallow from grass-fed beef, a high-quality, you know, estate olive oil, so healthy fats, and then herbs, because they provide such a wealth of antioxidant phytochemicals. Herbs can be some of the most nutrient-dense plant foods around. So we get this, you know, there's great healthy fats, flavorful fats, and wonderful, you know, seasonings that we can use. And then we have this diet that's really based on sort of a meat and vegetable. What, you know, really, we brand this as AIP. It's not that different from standard paleo or primal or ancestral health, but it's also not that different from clean eating. There's a lot of aspects in common with a plant-based diet. There's a lot of aspects in common with Mediterranean diet. So we really look at, you know, a very, you know, scientific research-based approach. So what does the research tell us in terms of how this food is going to interact with human health and whether or not this food is going to work or is likely to work for people with autoimmune disease. And then you frame all of that with this is an elimination diet. This is a diet that's designed to cut out the most likely culprits in terms of contributing to our chronic health problems. But there is a part built into this diet is reintroducing especially these foods that have some nutritive value, but maybe some inflammatory compounds, but because they have compelling nutrition, let's after we're feeling well and we've eliminated these from our diets for a sufficient length of time that we can really identify whether or not they're working for us, let's methodically reintroduce them to really find our own individual tolerance to them. So there's this other aspect of the autoimmune protocol that is respecting bioindividuality and giving us the tools to really hone in on what's optimal for us. Because what's optimal in terms of diet is dependent on lifestyle. So how well you're sleeping and how active you are and how well managed your stress is will impact whether or not a suboptimal food is going to work. Genetics is going to impact that. What chronic health problems you're challenged with is going to impact it, how long you've had, how aggressive they are, what tissues they're affecting, right? So it's a really complex equation. So the autoimmune protocol, beyond just being a dietary template with some lifestyle priorities incorporated, is really a entire toolbox for being able to understand our bodies and make the most informed choices for our own long life, our lifelong health.
Awesome. That is basically the best summary I think I've ever heard. thank you. So something that you mentioned within that AIP is so focused on being a nutrient seeker and not just like, hey, let's slash these foods out, but let's talk about you know, what we are eating and the nutrient density and the quality of those foods rather than just focusing on what we're not eating. So we have a couple questions about being a nutrient seeker and finding the most nutrients.
Sure.
So first, I would love to hear your opinion on this. What do you think about the clean 15 and the dirty dozen with organic fruits and vegetables? Because we know not everybody can buy organic everything. So when people are trying to prioritize, is that a good bar for figuring out which is the best?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that there's this really important caveat for the autoimmune protocol, which is, you know, it shouldn't be stressful. Mm. So when we're talking about these dietary priorities within a really tight budget or living in a food desert, right? These are extra challenges that, especially the food quality, right? So we have this pinnacle of food quality of grass-fed and grass-finished organic beef and local in-season organic produce grown in, you know, soil that's, you know, enriched with fertilizer from those grass-fed cows, right? Like we have this pinnacle of food quality, and it's worthwhile seeking out that pinnacle of quality because those, you know, whether it's the highest quality vegetables, the highest quality meats and seafood, they do have more nutrition. So they have more nutrients. When you're talking about animal foods, they have better fats. When you're talking about plant foods, they have more phytochemicals, typically more vitamins and minerals. So it is worthwhile, but is it a non-starter if you can't? And I think it's really important to emphasize that you will get tremendous bang for your buck just by looking at the overall template, right? So just picking the most nutrient-dense foods within that template that you have access to, remembering things like canned fish is very affordable. It can be a great way to get fish and shellfish into our diets in an affordable way. You know, if you're stuck in a standard grocery store and there's no organic produce there, you're still doing better by picking, non-organic vegetables than you are by like going back to, well, I'll just eat whatever then, right? Like it's still better for you to have non-organic cabbage than it is to have a peanut butter sandwich. So, so I think it's really important to emphasize that if you have barriers to organic produce or locally grown or grass-fed meat or wild-caught seafood, but that's not a non-starter. You can get, say, let's say 90-95% of the way with the conventional, factory farmed versions of those foods. There are some extra considerations to keep in mind, and these are things that I write about pretty extensively in my new book, Paleo Principles, but I also have a discussion in The Paleo Approach, which is my autoimmune protocol focused first book, which is, help you hone in. If you're stuck in a standard grocery store, what are the considerations? So one is it's a little bit more challenging to balance omega-6s and omega-3s. So what do you need to think about? And how do you, it's a little bit more challenging, for example, to get organ meat into your diet. If you're in a standard grocery store, you might find chicken livers, but like, how can you get around that? How can you solve that issue? So I think there's some different considerations if you're stuck with that. But then to go specifically to Dirty Dozen versus Clean 15, the research in terms of pesticide exposure, actually, let's take a step back. Pesticides are immunotoxic. So they impact our immune system in bad ways. However, all of the research that we have about the effect of pesticides on human health comes from studies of occupational exposure. And there's a little bit of information from the Nurses Health study showing that the more casual residential exposure of, say, you use pesticides in your garden, that those can have health effects. We do not have any evidence whatsoever that the extremely small amount of pesticide residues that are left on conventionally grown produce actually impact our health. That being said, we are talking about a population that is more sensitive to signals to our immune system to be overactive. So I think that if it's affordable, we do know that depending on how it's grown, organic produce can be just as sort of nutrient depleted as industrial now that we've got these like large scale organic farms. They also still have depleted soil. But if you're looking at, if you can get them from smaller farms, if you can get it locally, you are talking about a food that has more nutritive value, and you're avoiding, even though we don't have proof that pesticides are a problem, you're still taking that out of the equation. Because we don't know it is, we don't know for sure that it's not either. So you take that out of the equation. And what the Environmental Working Group does every year is they look at 50 common fruits and vegetables that you get in your grocery store, and they evaluate the amount and different numbers of pesticide residues on those foods, and they come up with a list of Dirty Dozen and Clean 15. So the Dirty Dozen are the ones that have the most pesticide residues or most different kinds of pesticides, and Clean 15 are the ones that have the least. And so if you have a little bit more money to commit to your food budget, I actually think that the number one place that should go is healthy fats. So before organic produce, I think a really high quality estate olive oil. I think of grass-fed tallow, high quality coconut oil, right? So first place is these super healthy fats, I think, is the first place that deserves the extra money. And then the second place is, okay, let's look at how can we get higher quality produce that's going to have more nutrients and also take this pesticide piece out of the equation. And that's where the Dirty Dozen list and the Clean 15 list can be very informative, because it can help narrow in on, okay, I'm going to spend $5 extra on produce, which ones? And you see there's certain frequent flyers of the Dirty Dozen list, right? Leafy greens make it very often. Celery makes it very often. Stone fruits, apple family make it very often. So you kind of go, okay, well, those are the ones that I'll buy organic. But keep in mind too, if you're going to peel that apple, you're peeling away 99.999% of whatever pesticide residues are on there. So then you go, okay, well, if I'm going to peel that apple, or I'm going to peel that, banana or orange, well, then I'm not going to worry about it being organic. And then when you have even a little bit more money, then you can start getting really invested in local food movement. and ramp up the quality like 100 times.
Mm-hmm. That's an awesome answer. And I'm sure that you just, so many people probably took a big sigh of relief listening to that, because I think we can get really just kind of uppity about everything needs to be the utmost best quality. And yeah, I mean, if you can get great quality, then great, but you're also not harming yourself. Like you said, just picking out canned vegetables versus a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, like, you know, which one's the better option here? So,
right. And I mean, as Rob Wolf would say, don't let perfection be the enemy of the good.
Totally. Totally agree.
I think it's really important to respect our own challenges to implementing the Autoimmune Protocol. And if the budget is one of them, then there's a give and take, and there's some really obvious places to be able to compromise. And one of them is food quality, if we can stick within the framework.
Totally agree. So I really wanted to be able to dive into this question about plant-based diets, because so many people had questions about this when we asked them what questions they had for you. And I know they ask me this all the time, and probably you too, Anne, but plant-based is just a huge topic right now with all of the documentaries and the articles coming out. It's a really hot topic, and everybody wants to try to be plant-based, or tons of people are coming from plant-based. So the Autoimmune Protocol is highly plant-based. There are a lot
of things
to be in your diet, yes, but it's
the Autoimmune Protocol is a plant-based diet.
I totally agree.
But it's not plant-based diet.
Exactly. It's not vegan. It's not a vegan diet. And lots of people out there are looking to be vegan, or they want to dabble in both. So lots of people are asking, well, I want to be vegan. There's all this talk about how great veganism is, or ethically I want to do this, or I am doing this, but I also want to experience the benefits of the Autoimmune Protocol. So what would you say to those folks who are coming from that world into this, or want to kind of dabble in both?
Yeah, so I would say the Autoimmune Protocol is not compatible with veganism, and veganism is not compatible with healing from chronic disease, period. So I don't want to mince words there at all. So yes, I called the Autoimmune Protocol a plant-based diet. That's because when you're eating 8 servings of vegetables a day as a minimum, 2/3 to 3/4 of every plate of food that you're eating is covered in vegetables and some fruit. It really is an incredibly veggie-rich diet. But the fact is that as much research as there is showing us the importance of eating a lot of vegetables, right? There's a tremendous body of scientific literature, and it's completely uniform across the board. Eating tons of vegetables benefits health, and there does not seem to be an upper limit in terms of vegetable servings. So, studies say now 8 a day is the best, but that's because they have such a hard time recruiting enough people who eat more than that to be able to get some powerful statistics, right? So we know that 8 a day is best, but we can't even measure if 14 a day is better, because that's so hard to get in a scientific study. But there really doesn't seem to be an upper limit in terms of vegetable consumption. We know that there are mechanistic links between compounds in meat and cancer incidence. And when you eat a lot of vegetables, it completely negates those mechanisms. So those mechanisms only occur in people who aren't eating vegetables. So in terms of like meat cancer connection, yeah, it's a real connection, but it's only relevant if you're not eating a lot of vegetables. So if you're eating a lot of vegetables, you are changing how those compounds are metabolized in your body. They are not metabolized into carcinogens. Meat becomes a very different food in that space. And then the other really important thing here is we're talking about nutrient deficiencies as being causal for chronic disease. You know, there is some research to show that celiac disease can only occur if you are zinc deficient. So, there's this really strong genetic link, right? We understand the mechanisms. We know the antibodies that are being produced. Guess what? If you start off zinc deficient, that's what allows that entire cascade to occur. The top food sources of zinc are animal foods, especially shellfish. So there are nutrients that we absolutely need from plant foods. I think the importance of phytochemicals, the importance of fiber is so underrated. And I really think that, you know, if you look at the USDA guidelines of 28 grams of fiber for women a day and 30 to 38 grams for men a day, that is so much less than hunter-gatherers get. Hunter-gatherers get between 50 and 200 grams of fiber a day. I don't think fiber can be emphasized enough in terms of its importance in human health, because plant fiber is what feeds our gut bacteria, and they impact every system in our body. They are just so, we are a symbiotic colony, that we are not an individual organism, right? We are only healthy when we have those few trillion diverse different types of probiotic bacteria in our digestive tracts and other tissues in our body. So plants are amazing. And I don't want to detract from the importance of a veggie-rich diet, but there are nutrients in animal foods that we absolutely need in order to be healthy that we cannot get from plant foods. So animal foods in a diet is a necessity. It is a necessary component of a health-promoting diet. And when you look at vegan diets, nutrient deficiencies catch up with vegans eventually and undermine their health. So I think that what we do is we look at the scientific research, and we're drawing on a lot of the same research that plant-based diet people are drawing on, in terms of this emphasis on vegetables, this emphasis on high-quality olive oil, eating the rainbow. You know, these are all very, very well-established, great scientific research as being important components of a health-promoting diet. But we pair that with an understanding that seafood, that high-quality meat, that organ meat, is providing our body with nutrients to fill those gaps. And it doesn't mean we need to eat a ton of meat. Something like a 6-ounce serving at every meal is going to be adequate for everybody. Even 4 ounces, if it's a denser protein source, or something like organ meat or shellfish, is going to be an adequate animal food serving for everybody. But it is a necessary component of a health promoting diet. So if you're looking to mitigate chronic disease, if you are looking to reverse autoimmune disease, you cannot do that without the nutrients that are present in animal foods.
Awesome, awesome, awesome answer. I cannot wait to just take this and send it all over to everybody. And you have this information.
I just made a lot of people angry though.
But yeah. But I mean, it's tough love. I totally agree.
So we've been diving into all of these specifics on AIP, but I want to kind of take a step back, because this, I tend to get people questioning, and even I was in the same position before I started the autoimmune protocol, questioning whether this particular protocol will help for what they have. So Do you think that the autoimmune protocol is for every autoimmune disease?
So I think that many people do not need to do the full autoimmune protocol. You can approach this two ways, right? So you can approach this as, okay, let me take paleo. Let me take the nutrient dense focus and the sleep and stress management activity and all that good stuff. Let me take that, and then let me play with these eliminations. So let me cut out nightshades. That's probably the most inflammatory paleo food that is eliminated on the autoimmune protocol. Let me tackle these eliminations methodically, and I'll cut something out for a few weeks and see how I do. And so you can kind of take it that way, or you can take it the other way, which is how the autoimmune protocol is really framed. I'm going to go full autoimmune protocol for 30 days, and then I'm going to methodically reintroduce. It is easier and faster to identify how foods are working for you if you cut out all the most likely culprits and then methodically add them back in, compared to including a lot of them and methodically cutting them out. Because let's give the example of a nightshade versus grass-fed dairy. So let's say you're doing paleo, you're eating grass-fed dairy, nightshades, right? And they're, let's say nightshades are the one that's a problem. So you cut out dairy, you still don't feel good. But does that tell you that dairy wasn't the problem? Because maybe it was dairy and nightshades, and maybe you had to cut them both out. So when it starts being there's like more than one food that really needs to be eliminated from your diet because your body's not responding to it well, when you do the cut things out one by one, it can be really hard to identify those foods. So in all of that conversation, it's really important to emphasize that the autoimmune protocol, again, it is an elimination diet. Reintroductions is part of the template. So it's not a here's how you have to eat for the rest of your life. It's here is your framework for understanding how foods might impact your health. And here is the tools that you need to be able to figure out these sort of middle ground gray area foods, how they're actually impacting you. And I actually think that, you know, even there's some non-paleo foods that can even eventually be reintroduced and start working. So for example, I have recently reintroduced lentils. And have found them to be a really, like, I feel better with them, and probably because they're just so high in fiber, which is one of the reasons why I was interested in reintroducing them. And so that's a food that I reintroduced 4 or 5 months ago. And so that's a non-paleo food, right? They're a legume. They're not considered paleo. They're certainly not considered autoimmune protocol. But I think there's some, even some foods in that sort of gray area, something like natto, right? Fermented soybeans, one of the top food source, or the top food source of vitamin K2, you know, has some vitamin B12, right? It's one of the very, very few plant sources of B12, has some really interesting nutrients. And because it's fermented for so long, the problematic compounds in soy are mostly degraded. So I think there's some foods that are not part of the paleo framework that can eventually, I mean, they're not the early introductions. We're going to reintroduce the most likely foods to work for us that have the most nutritive value. But I think there are things that can get added to this list to play with. So I think it's really important to look at the autoimmune protocol as a strategy for honing in on the diet that our bodies need to be healthy as individuals, and let that framework guide our decision making. So that means that, you know, the fastest way to get to that point is to follow the autoimmune protocol, the elimination phase of the autoimmune protocol, follow that really carefully for a period of time. I don't like putting a definitive time cap on it. I generally say until you're starting to feel better. You need to be feeling better in order to identify if a food makes you feel worse. Ideally, until you're feeling a lot better, because then it's even easier to identify if a food's making you feel worse. So for some people, that's a few weeks, and for some people, that's months. Occasionally, it's a year or two. That tends to happen for people who have lifestyle barriers to really healing. So it tends to be people who have a harder time with sleep or stress management. For, you know, not necessarily because they're not implementing those correctly, but because they have some other challenge that's affecting those. So that means that they just need longer with this clean diet to be able to get to a point where they can really tell when a food's not working properly for them with reintroductions. So that's the fastest way, right? Follow this elimination, then methodically reintroduce, and you can keep methodically reintroducing for years, right? There's so much to play with. And it can sometimes be a moving target. So I keep my diet much, much cleaner when I'm traveling, for example, because traveling is so hard on me physically that I need to make up for that with, like, there's no suboptimal foods that are going to be challenging my immune system while I'm traveling. So I think that really we need to look at the autoimmune protocol as a journey, as a learning experience, as a way of really understanding how our bodies react to our environment, right? Diet and lifestyle is part of our environment, so that we can not just regain our health, but then maintain that health for the rest of our lives. So no, not everyone needs the autoimmune protocol, but it is still the fastest way to get to that point where you really understand what your body needs to be healthy.
Totally agree. Gosh, there's so many questions that we could ask just forever. One that we probably want to close this out with before we get to kind of your updates and where people can find you is one that we've all run into with folks who say that I've been trying this diet for X amount of time and I'm not feeling better. It's not working like I want it to. What would you say to those folks who are trying it and are not seeing the success early on with it like they'd like to?
So the first question that I always ask if somebody, you know, comes up to me at an event and says, you know, I've been following the AIP for X period of time and this is what I was hoping would happen that didn't happen. The first question I ask is, how is your sleep? That is the most common barrier, I think, to healing. The regulatory aspects of our immune system work predominantly while we're asleep. We need sleep in order for our bodies to heal, sleep is critical for turning off inflammation in the brain. Inflammation in the brain impacts every system in our bodies. But there's a special communication between, you know, brain and gut. So if there's inflammation in the brain, there's inflammation in the gut. And that's the way it goes. So sleep is really important for correcting a lot of things, correcting hormone imbalances and hormone sensitivity problems, such as insulin resistance. So sleep is really critical. And the most common response that I get to that is tears. Yeah, I'm not sleeping well. So sleep is my first, like, let's evaluate, can you make more time for sleep? Can you change some habits during the day to improve sleep quality? So for example, spending some time outside during the day, keeping the lights dim in the evening, tackling sleep hygiene. So sleep's first, stress is second. So if I get the answer of, nope, my sleep's dialed in, I sleep 9 hours every night, I sleep great, then it's okay. So how well managed is your stress? When looking at stress, we're looking at what can you take off your plate? So what stressors can you eliminate from your life, but also what things can you add to your life that will improve your resilience to stress? So taking up mindfulness practice is probably the most efficient, because you can get statistically, you know, from scientific studies, you can get pretty great results with as little as 10 to 15 minutes a day. But you know, some people, when they really get into mindfulness and they want to, you know, sit for an hour, right? Then that becomes a major part of their day. But walking outside, right? Then you got two birds with one stone there. Nature time, family time, hobby time, laughing, right? There's lots of other things that we can add to our day that will mean that the stressors that we have in our life don't impact us physically as much. So I go sleep, then stress, and then are you working with a functional medicine specialist? Because there are underlying problems that can be there that are really challenging to address with lifestyle and diet. So for example, if you have a parasite, no amount of kale and liver is going to cure that, you know, that parasite. But that parasite might be what is constantly stimulating the immune system. Adrenal issues can be like the healing from very severe adrenal issues can take years. That process can be expedited with working with a functional medicine specialist, really taking a detailed look at adrenal function and catering an adaptogen protocol for exactly what your adrenals are doing. Hormone imbalances, they do get better with diet and lifestyle, but again, it's one of those things where the imbalances are driving inflammation and the inflammation is driving the imbalances. So doing some testing with a functional medicine specialist, looking at exactly what's going on, and tailor whether it's hormone supplementation or some kind of supplements to deal with hormone excesses, right? There's lots of different options. That can expedite healing. Looking at, for me, one of my big challenges was low thyroid function, because the thyroid hormones feed into sex hormones and feeds into the immune system and feeds into the adrenal axis. And as soon as I was able to do thyroid hormone replacements and get my thyroid levels within range, everything else kind of came together for me. So if it's, you're really doing the diet, you're really doing the nutrient density piece. So you're really doing the fish and shellfish and organ meat, lots of vegetable piece. And then you're really doing sleep and you're really mitigating stress. You know, the next step is find a, you know, qualified functional or integrative medicine specialist to work with to help you dig deeper, because sometimes that is required. And that doesn't make you a failure. If you need to take a medication, if you need to do antibiotics for SIBO, right? If you, or an antibiotic course for Lyme, right? There's all kinds of situations where conventional medicine has a great pharmaceutical option for us. That doesn't make you a failure. It doesn't mean you didn't AIP hard enough, but it also doesn't take away what AIP can do. So just because you might need some kind of medical intervention, it doesn't mean that following the AIP is pointless. It still can help mitigate issues, reduce the need for medication. It can still help prevent additional chronic health problems from creeping up in the future. it's still a nutrient-dense diet that supports overall health. So take both sides of that, right? So if you do need to dig deeper with a functional medicine specialist, that doesn't make you a failure, but it doesn't get you off the hook of actually working hard to make healthy diet and lifestyle choices either.
Totally.
Yeah, thanks so much for explaining that, because I do, that's something that I see all the time is people say, well, I've been on this for a year and a half or however long, and I'm not seeing any results. And yeah, they're wondering what the next step is. When do you think there is a point where somebody takes a look at what they've been doing and realizes, okay, I've been doing all these things that you listed, I've been doing them really well for a certain amount of time. Like, what duration of time do you think they need to follow those steps before they look into a functional medicine practitioner?
So if you are following autoimmune protocol to the letter, you're not food phobic, so you're eating a diversity of vegetables, you're incorporating organ meat and lots of seafood, your sleep styled in, you're active but not overactive, you're mitigating stress or managing stress well, you've got all of those things dialed in, and you're still not seeing any change, you know, like any change, I would say as little as 2 to 3 months.
Okay. Right?
If you're not seeing anything happen, if you're seeing a little, like one of the things that can happen is we didn't get sick overnight. We're not going to get better overnight either. Most people take several months to really start to feel amazing. I would probably say something like 6 months is the modal time where people start to go, okay, like this was the best thing I've ever done, right? But most people are noticing a difference building up to that 6 month mark. Now it is possible that the change is so gradual that it's just like we kind of dismiss and ignore when we don't feel great. Sometimes we can dismiss and ignore when we're feeling better and not really appreciate it. So, you know, number one is let's be really mindful. Like, you know, maybe keep a symptom journal. You know, you can pair that with a sleep journal, right? Because sleep quality can tell us a lot. Mood, right? Just how well we handle stress, how happy we feel. Those things can be really good indicators of healing. If you engage in some kind of sport that has a way of measuring progress in that sport, because when we're really sick, we tend to not, you know, be hitting personal records at our sport. So having some kind of journal that can help us track things that might seem to be a little bit more tangential in terms of how we measure our success. Keep in mind things like skin conditions can take a lot longer to respond just because skin's a lower priority organ for the human body. So we have to heal internally typically quite substantially before we start healing externally. But you know, there should be gradual improvement that is observable by at least the 2 month mark. Most people, it's quite a bit earlier than that. Most people, it's within the first few weeks. So if you're not seeing that, I don't think you need to keep banging your head against the wall. If you're not seeing improvement, then, seeking a healthcare professional that can help do some functional testing and see if there's something that's holding you back. I think doing that sooner rather than later, budget permitting, because of course a lot of these doctors are, you know, don't take insurance and they can be quite expensive. But that, it doesn't make sense to me to forge ahead with no results, right? So I think that within a couple of months, if you're really not starting to see some changes, digging deeper makes a lot of sense. You know, they say, right, the definition of insanity is keep doing the same thing but expect a different result. Mm-hmm. So I think the autoimmune protocol requires some patience. The road to healing can be slow, but we should be seeing steady progress, even if it is slow progress. And if we're not, that's when it's time to call in the reinforcements.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Sarah, it has been just such an honor and a pleasure to have you here today. We are, you know, just so excited to be able to share this amazing resource with everyone. So People should probably know where they can find you. I'll ask anywhere. Where can people find you, and what cool stuff do you have coming up right now that you want people to know about? I know you have a tour coming up.
I do. So let's start with, thank you so much for having me. Everyone can find me at thepaleomom.com. And from there, you can link to everything that I do, my social media sites, my podcast, right, all of the things I do. But I do have a book tour coming up because my fourth book is coming out November 7th. And this is totally my new book baby, right? This one is my favorite. You're not supposed to have a favorite, but this one's absolutely my favorite. It's called Paleo Principles. It is an epic encyclopedic tome. It's 672 pages. It's a deep dive into the science. So it's a general health book as opposed to autoimmune focus, but it has a lot of autoimmune content, including some topics that I did not have the opportunity to dive into detail in the Paleo approach. So there's a lot in this book for my AIPers. More than half of the recipes are AIP recipes. So this book includes, right, it's like, I don't know the exact page count, but let's say 450-ish pages of science. And then 225-ish recipes, more than half of which are AIP. So it really is designed to be an all-in-one resource, and it has a ton of content. So for people who are following the autoimmune protocol, but maybe you're dealing with other chronic health issues, I go into diabetes and cardiovascular disease and cancer and kidney disease and performance and kids' health and family and mental health, right? It's all wrapped up into this book. But I'd be able to really get into some topics that, in my opinion, are missing from the Paleo approach, like the role of adrenal function and how adrenal fatigue can undermine health. So there's a lot of things that I've been able to go into much more detail. So it is, even though it's a general health book, it is very, very relevant, and it has a lot of additional information that my other books don't have, that my website doesn't have, that is in this book. So you can pre-order it now. It's available on all online retailers. It will be coming out as on the major ebook platforms, so Kindle, Nook, Kobo, iTunes, although I don't think you can pre-order it on those platforms. So pre-orders are hugely appreciated. And so far my book tour has me in Seattle, San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Atlanta. So if you live anywhere near those cities, I would love for you to come out and meet me. And you can get information on my book tour at thepaleomom.com/events and see all of the events. We're still working on one more location for the tour too. So that's exciting. So I'm hoping that everybody comes out to meet me and gives me a hug, because I mean, they don't have to hug me. I won't force my hugs on people, but I am a hugger. So if you want a hug, I will always give you one.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
Well, thanks again for having me. This has been great.
Well, thank you guys for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to the Unbound Healing Podcast. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes and leave us a review. Until next time, you can find more from me, Anne, at grassfedsalsa.com, and more from Michelle at unboundwellness.com. We'll see you next week. Bye.